First, I would like to start by thanking KITP and the organizers of the Pattern Program to have me here as a long-term participant, especially Eberhard and Peter. I would especially like to thank, I can edit these later in my talk. I would especially like to thank Pierre and Len and their families because they have really listened to me, whatever stupid things I had to ask and discuss. And many other visitors who have been here and who are not here today. And I've had a very good time here. Okay. I really always like to show my institute picture. This is the picture of my institute in India. It's one of the best institutes in molecular biology. I'm not so sure about theory. Pardon me?
Is that whole structure that we're looking at devoted to molecular biology?
Yes, right.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Three wings. There's one more wing on that side. Oh yeah, they're very good. Except that they're very good. Look at, I'm going ahead in my talk. Where I am. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. What I'm going to speak today is a very long-term project that I have. I've been working on it, as you can see, from 1987 till this year. I have one graduate student and one scientist with me who have been working this project on modeling biochemical pathways. I showed these three papers, which is it might sound that they're really ancient. They are ancient. But the point is that this paper is still being referred as one of the first models of what I'm going to show. And it's referred even a year back, a paper by Mackey and PNAS, when they discussed this model as my model, one of the first models. Marci is just 2 years into graduate work, and she is basically doing more experimental work. Okay, the way I would like to, I have planned my talk is I would like to give a little introduction to biochemical pathways. Maybe it'll be too much. I'll see what are the ways biochemical pathways are being modeled. Then I would show two models. One of them is a real pathway being modeled, so biologists like to hear this. The other one is a model, which is, I call it a model biochemical pathway, because it has all the features that are present in a biochemical pathway, in real biochemical pathway, but I don't have an exact replica of it in the cell. But nevertheless, these are the ways the area is progressing now, and these kinds of models are becoming very important. And I like it because it has a lot of interesting dynamics. In this program, especially people who have been here for a long time, excuse me, they have been hearing about cells, all kinds of cells, cells in heart, cells in brain, cells in muscles, and what those special cells do at special times, wherever they are, all the details of them and how they work. This is just a slide to show you what kind of special length scales they have. It goes from this larger cell to these small bacteria. And they have all kinds of shapes and sizes. The bacteria themselves, this is E. coli, bacteria themselves has a very large length scale. All they are put under bacteria, but it's not just one generic shape and size for them. So they start from the smallest cell that is known is called a mycoplasma. It's about, this is its diameter, and the largest cell known as a nerve cell in a giraffe's neck, which goes almost to 10 feet in length. With this kind, okay. Most of my work is especially for pathways that are seen in E. coli, in a bacteria, because that's what is the best studied. It's about 3 micrometer long, it's rod shaped, and it's 1 micrometer in width. They divide, like you can see, the way they divide, these are asexual, these are not sexual divisions. But an equivalent, say, eukaryotic cell, these are called prokaryotic cells because the DNA, and there are several features that differentiate between a eukaryotic cell and a prokaryotic cell. The cell walls and the DNA does not have an enclosure like nucleus, etc. A typical eukaryotic cell is, I have given the scale here, it's about 10 micrometer. So they are large, basically they are very large. And they are much more complex. Even the cell cycle time has a lot of variation. It goes all the way from 20 minutes. This is the first lowest eukaryotic cell. It goes all the way almost six times of this. And a rapidly dividing mammalian cell, or shown here, takes about 24 hours. So the cells are different in various aspects, shape, size, length, time scales, and division time also. And we have seen so many different functions in earlier program talks. Now, this is inside of a eukaryotic cell. It's extremely complex. There are several different organs, organelles, which do many different functions. We have been hearing about some of them. The thing that I would like you to notice is, if you look at the approximate chemical composition of a bacterial cell, this is not a bacterial cell. This is larger, but still, bacterial cell is smaller. But this is in percentage. Most of it is water. And the next highest concentration are macromolecules, which are proteins, DNA, and polysaccharides, of which I haven't given the numbers, what is how many of them there. This is just the number of types. There is only one DNA. Actually, in a dividing cell, there is about average 2 point something. So one molecule. Then onwards, there are really large number of molecules. So you really don't. Polysaccharides and lipids and fatty acids, they are many, many, many more in number. So the recent excitement in biology has been always to look into to sequence the genomes, and people have gone starting from E. coli to small viruses to many other bacteria, which are primarily parasites, to human genome. And there's a vast diversity. It goes from 1.2 millimeter. This is just a scale. No biologist actually looks at it. They look at this 4 million base pair to about 3,000 million base pairs. But you can see that even a length of this one molecule of this length is put into 1 micrometer. There is a lot of complexity and structural complexity also, which is a completely different area. Now, this is a slide I want to spend a little time here. I don't have to generally, but I would like to spend, because the rest of the talk is, when I understand this, how the information flows, it's useful. Okay, so this is how it's made out of four bases. It's a long string of four bases arranged in linear fashion. This is the DNA. The information that has to be transferred from generation to generation is coded in this. So then when it wants to make these workhorse molecules, which are the proteins, which actually do most of the jobs in the cell, it goes through a process called transcription and translation. So basically, the information is translated into another set of molecules. These are amino acids. These are either made in the cell or obtained from with our food. And then these proteins, some of them become enzymes, which take part in these reactions. This is a typical biochemical reaction where a substrate is made into another substrate to other substrates with the use of enzymes. They're enzyme active. And some of these also go and interact earlier or later to show how the whole process is controlled. And all these biochemical reactions actually control the cellular physiology. So the inside the cell, all these things are there. So the flow of information goes down like that, the complexity goes down like that, and inside the cell, what the cell does is decided by all these different units. So in some sense, since the cellular physiology, or what the cell does, is decided primarily by these reactions, biochemical reactions in the cell, one can approximately say, it's a first order approximation, that a cell is nothing but a collection of interacting biochemical pathways. It's integrated into overall reaction network through several different controls, and I'll come to that. And this allows it to do all these kinds of things that we see a cell to do. It coordinates its different activities, it regulates its state of itself in different environment. It decides whether it has to go from one state to another, and it also has the ability to evolve from one to the other. Okay, so given the assumption that the complex circuitry of biochemical reactions in cells actually coordinate and control cellular function, and I also said that the control is through both through several means, and two of them, the most two most important ones, are the genetic reactions and the metabolic reactions. The way one can define these, they are actually interacting sets, but the way one can define it in, to some sense, is metabolic reactions are these chemicals that are sitting inside the cytoplasm of the cell, and they, one of them is made from the earlier one, as I showed in the reaction network. Genetic reactions involve all these reactions like transcription, translation, which involves the DNA and RNA and makes the enzymes which take part in these reactions. So it's a interacting set. They have different time scales, and it's important because it's important when one writes the model. Time scales are such that the genetic reactions are generally slow. It's in terms of minutes and sometimes hours. But the time scales of metabolic reactions are quite fast. They are in terms of seconds and minutes. These are just examples of different types of cell. Different types of reactions that one can put under what are metabolic reactions and what are genetic reactions or epigenetic reactions. So I've been talking about what biochemical pathways, but how do they look? So this is how they look. These are all schematic. This is schematic, of course, and this is the pathway which is written in, drawn in a specific manner, like a wire diagram inside the bacteria E. coli. So there are several sections which have been given colors which do specific jobs, like this particular cycle actually takes care of carbohydrate. This particular cycle makes lipids. There is this whole set which makes and breaks amino acids. This is metabolism, so they make amino acids, vitamins, and other substrates, etc.
What does exactly this mean when you have a line between those two points? I mean, see, two things are reacting with each other?
Oh, yes. So each node is a substrate, and this is the direct interaction between the two substrates. Now, this is what I would call as a metabolic pathway, metabolic reactions. This I would talk, I would say it's kind of example of a genetic pathway. And this is nothing but the protein-protein interaction network in yeast. This people have found this out experimentally by doing something called two hybrid analysis. And they found this is how the interaction network looks. So each node is a protein, and each link between the two nodes is direct physical interaction between two protein. And you can see that how complex it is.
You call that right one genetics still?
I call it genetics because it's interaction between two proteins. As I said, that at the protein level, whether it's enzyme or protein, it's actually overlapping.
Some kind of catalytic effect could be on either side.
Actually,
it's sort of interesting. Could you go back to that picture?
Sure.
It seems to be absolutely different, the kind of connections of that picture and this picture. Here, it's kind of like you have pumps.
You know, I think it also matters how you plot it. Like, this is one of the most connected, so it does matter how you plot it.
In fact, so it's sort of obscure.
This is plotted primarily for people who want to use large network analysis. We'll come to that. Okay, so we can see that biochemical reactions are highly networked reactions. How are they controlled? How are they regulated? Because there are so many interactions inside, reactions inside the cell, but the cell doesn't go mad over trying to decide which one to do when. It obviously is very well regulated and controlled. And the primary mode of regulation, of course there are others, but the primary mode of regulation is through feedback processes. And these are either single, multiple, or couple negative and positive feedback processes. Now,
What is single, multiple?
Oh, I'll just show some examples, right. Then it will become clear. So we know that, physics or from even common sense, that negative feedback basically desensitizes the system to perturbations. It tries to bring the system back onto a steady state. It's actually one of the most common interactions in biological reactions, because it ensures stability and also it conserves energy, so reactions just don't go on forever and take up all the energy. And hence it's evolutionarily selected to be the most common form of regulation. Positive feedbacks, though they are destabilizing, but they are also used in several interactions, such as switching, when a cell has to switch from one type to another, or some rapid response processes such as blood clotting. Now, so what one sees a cell to do is actually it's an emergent property of many complex biochemical reactions, which are networked through feedback feedforward processes, which have also very wide ranging time scales. Now, the reason why we like to, or physicists or theoreticians like to do this kind of, try to model these, is that the underlying assumption is, of course it's so complex, but there must be some generic similarities, and we should like to see how they are. The nice thing is that they can be modeled using rules of chemical kinetics, which are fairly abstract. And one can look into, after modeling, look into what are the general features that one can extract from different types of models. Now, when we look at a biochemical pathway or we try to model it, as far as I'm concerned, I look at its dynamics. What kind of dynamics does the pathway, I treat it like a dynamical system. Now, in a dynamical system, there are several different types of behavior that one can see. Stable is supposed to be the most common one because it's equivalent to homeostasis. There are multi-stable systems that allows the cell to operate on alternative conditions, such as, say, carbon sources. When it has one type of carbon source or another type of carbon source, it can go from one to the other type. It also needs threshold sensitivity. We have heard a lot about it on nerve cells. It requires several oscillatory reactions because it has many, many cyclic processes, such as cell division cycles. It also shows interesting bursting activity and irregular behavior, which people have tried hard to show that they are chaotic activity. So since these are very general, so this generality in dynamics seems to allow us to do theoretical studies in these pathways, and also to be able to predict some function in meaningful or useful results. When we write down an equation, the functional dynamics is of course a consequence of the nonlinearity inherent in the multiple modes of biochemical regulation, which will come up as the models are written. This slide is just to show that some examples of, if you want to study sustained oscillations, these are the some examples where one can see sustained oscillation. One wants to study bursting and complex oscillations. There are some situations where one can see bursting activity. It's quite common in neural cells. One of the interesting processes which a lot of mathematicians actually avoided earlier, because one of the things the mathematicians are not interested in are transients. They are generally interested in what happens in the final state. But transient processes are very important in biology, because sometimes a biological system really never reaches the steady state. It's always on transient. And a lot of stuff that is coming up lately, which can be actually transient processes and not long-term. Now, to have any of these kinds of dynamics, a combination of negative and positive feedback processes, or of different combinations of them, are actually required. It should allow the cell to have stable, sensitive, and also multiplicity in their dynamics. This is actually from a textbook, and these are the multiple types of controls that one can multiple types of feedback processes, which one can see in biochemical reactions. And when I talked about multiple feedbacks, this is what I meant. Like, you have This is the simplest. It's called monovalent control. Here's a set of linear reaction system, and the end product goes and inhibits or activates the first step of the reaction. So it's called end product inhibition or end product activation. But then if there's a branching of pathways, then both of the end products actually need to regulate if they want to shift the flux going from here to each of these branches. So there are there are examples for each one of them in biochemical pathways, and they are extremely interesting because they are even there are situations where this is only 70%, this is 30%, depending on the requirement of the cell, which end product is required. So this is just two examples which one sees in biosynthetic pathways of amino acids. So you can see that these are nested controls and sequential because it goes one after another and nested. And this is one of those where it's branched and each of the branch themselves control this branch point and together control the first.
But this is just a diagrammatic representation of some ODEs.
No, this is what happens in the reaction.
Well,
when we write in ODE form, we'll just have a function which will be a negative feedback, a repression function on this step. But what happens is this molecule goes and interacts with the enzyme here
right.
and changes the structure.
Right, but what precisely you need are ODEs where you're just shifting either the rate constants or the coupling constants.
Also, the type of interaction there.
Yeah, well, that's the
yeah. No. If the type of interaction is, say, cooperative or non-cooperative, even the functional form makes a difference.
Right.
Yeah, and of course also.
All functional forms.
Yeah, and of course the coupling constants.
Some of them are turned on, and some of them are turned off. But I mean, precisely, this is understood as. ODEs.
In this form, yes, but in the complex form, in the large network form, people are not using ODEs. People are using graph theory, network theory. I'll just probably come to this. So there are three complementary approaches that people use for modeling biochemical pathways. One of them is known as forward engineering, which is really is the oldest method that you look at existing pathway, look at all the information that one can get from biology and biological experiments and genetic experiments, and try to model this. So it's kind of, you use the reductionist approach to study an existing pathway. One of the things is one have to know, understand that all biochemical pathways are not fully optimized for various reasons. I mean, for evolutionary reasons. So what one is modeling is a pathway which is there in the cell, but it may not be the best way to make that. Okay. When it comes to large networks, like they're not optimized because there are many times that the cell actually may change environment, and it allows itself to be in a state where it can sense the change in environment. So it's optimized with respect to different environments. So if it never saw the second environment, it probably would have done the first one in a much better way. But because it has to be ready for changing an environment.
It's optimizing something different.
Different, yeah. So that's right.
I think it's optimizing anything.
It isn't, into some sense. But it all depends on what kind of pathway it is. Okay. Yeah?
I mean, you're saying, you're sort of assuming that evolution always optimizes it completely, but how would you know that?
No, it can't.
It doesn't. I'm trying to say it is, it doesn't.
No, these guys are.
Oh, okay. That's what one would like it to be. Okay.
Right.
So when one looks at large networks, they are really, it's very difficult to use. The reason I showed these are for this and the what is known as rational network design, like people are now trying to make artificial networks with specific properties, which are based on mathematical models. These two, we still use ODEs, but in this one, it goes into thousands of ODEs or 500 ODEs. So people don't use, they're using graph theory and getting information from large-scale gene expression data. I'll just give you an example for this. So these are the three main areas in biochemical pathway modeling today that people are doing with a lot of help from the genomic information that's coming up. So why do we do theoretical studies on this? Of course, these are some of the things why I think it's important. I would like to see what are the common features in different pathways. Then we would like to see the differences in similar pathways in different organisms. It's a very interesting question. This is a question which we are approaching from when we are studying evolution of metabolic pathways or biochemical pathways in different microorganisms. In the sense, the same pathway, when we look at different microorganisms, some of it is very constant, some of it is different.
What about in one organism itself? Does it evolve?
The pathway itself, if it's the same organism and if it's not having any change, then it's the same. But if there's a mutation, of course there can be a change. But here you want to look at a amino acid biosynthetic pathway in a bacteria and another bacteria, or in a plant cell, in an animal cell. Some part of it is completely conserved, some part of it is not. And if they are different, what are the functional implications in terms of dynamics? At least that's my interest. Then of course, if we can predict new behavior, design new pathways, and of course correct if something. We can at least predict if I change these things, the pathway is going to behave this way. Okay, I'll just show, since we have just started working in this, so I'm not going to show any results on this. This is how people are trying to look at large networks, where they're trying to find out if there are structural, any design principles in this kind of pathways, and all those people who work on random graphs, scale-free graphs and everything, they have shown that most of these graphs are networks are actually scale free. So some of these nodes are actually very important, and hence, you know, if there is a random error, then it tolerates the network works fine. But if one wants to move one of these special nodes which are highly connected, then it's very fatal to the pathway. So
how much do people believe in exactly this? I mean, how much people do agree on these pathways?
They do. I would tell, actually I had many slides but I didn't want to show these. They do, because now what people are doing is they are taking, so this is an experimentally derived network, and now they are actually removing each of these nodes and trying to see what happens. And there's a whole lot of papers in 2002.
Knockouts?
Yeah, but right. And it's possible to do, because now biology has got this very large-scale gene expression method called microarray and proteomics, where they can study many, many reactions in one time, many, many functions in one time. This is a very active area in experiments, at least.
What does the graph, what does the graph look like if you plot the number of, say, nodes with, say, one connection,
okay,
two connections, three
so
connections.
I just,
is it an algebraic decay sort of thing?
No, I deleted that slide, but it would be, if it's scale-free, if it goes something like this.
Yeah.
And if it's kind of random, it goes like this. The nodes and the probability.
That is the number. The
number of nodes.
The parallel.
Yeah.
Is the exponent of that. Is that the number, like, is that the parallel?
It's about 1.2, yeah.
Or 1.2, yeah. I see. It's not, and that's fairly common for many?
At least the ones they have checked. There isn't too many of these available, because it...
Is that understood?
No, it's only, why it's 1.2, I don't know. At least I haven't read why it is 1.2. But it's understood what it means to have a parallel, that's all. What it means.
Scale.
Yeah, I think he can.
It's understood in the sense that if the graph grows,
yeah,
with a preferential attachment of incoming new node to, or as a function of the number of links the other nodes have, then you end up with a power of -3. And I think this has -2.5.
No, it's one.
I thought it was 1.2.
I think it's 1.2, but I don't know. I don't know.
Usually
there's a whole lot of
information. Do I think of that like a fixed point in statistical physics? I mean, do lots of systems sort of in some overall limit behave like
lots,
this?
Lots of systems yes. are observed to have this.
The internet.
Yeah. But this, yeah. this growth model that only gives a power law for of exactly three. If you change your growth model, you don't get a power law. You get something else. And so people would like to know why.
Why it's the only power law, you're saying.
No, between the only power law you get by a growth model is three.
Yeah.
Okay.
But if there's only one growth model.
If you change the growth model, you get stretch exponential and not power law. It's statement. People would like to know why you get all these twos and threes, and their claims, I think Thomas will probably agree with, is that these are things where the networks have a huge variance in the bond distribution,
infinite variance,
but a fixed mean, a and somehow that's supposed to be important. You agree with that?
Except if you ask a biologist, then they would like to hear it in terms of biological terms, and I don't think one really knows, other than the fact that, okay, there's some nodes which are really important. There's some mutations you can make which will kind of is completely fatal to the pathway, whereas some they aren't. Okay, the other area of work that's going on is rational network design, where people are now learn from the biochemical pathways that are there in the cell, and they are trying to make them. And the way why they are trying to make them is because if you ever try to make that pathway, that even the simplest pathway, it is so complex. But all that one needs is to find out some biological circuit which would do these kinds of functions. These are functions which people are interested in circuit theory. Like I need a small circuit which will give me linear output, which will give me a saturable output, which will give me some sort of oscillatory output. And other than the fact that people are interested in trying to do it just because it's really great fun to be able to take biological parts and say DNA and stuff like that and make things which behave like that. But it's also, it has some applications in the sense that one could use things like these kinds of circuits into genes which scientists might like to put into the cells and express it according to the way they want. So if it wants to be expressed in a linear manner or in a saturable manner or an oscillatory manner, they could just tag this circuit before the gene, make it go inside the cell, and then induce it so that it expresses the way it is needed to express. So this is another very interesting area that's going on, and people have started doing this last 3 years. I've just given two examples. Now, the way this works is that they take a small piece of DNA, which is the regulatory region, which means this is a part of a nucleic acid where a protein can come and bind and control the rest of the transcription translation procedure. So in simple terms, one can make these kinds of circuits where this is a simple negative feedback circuit. So one has has what is known as a promoter, regulatory region, and a gene, and something which would report. So generally, it's a green fluorescence protein that they put. And this circuit actually shows this kind of bistable situation. So one can make this, it's called toggle switch, but using a small circuit like this. And one can put the circuit inside the E. coli cell, and it shows this kind of behavior. My most favorite one is this, which is it's a set of three. Because this is a behavior which you see in the cell, this kind of circuits are seen in the cell, but nothing like this is seen in the cell. But they are all derived from different cells and put together in a designed manner to give rise to oscillations. So I think this is really what is called as artificial network. We have just started.
Some kind of solution?
They take parts of these from, they cut it out from, say, E. coli DNA or some other organism DNA. Then they do molecular biology techniques to join them, fuse them, and they fuse all these things.
In the cell.
Outside the cell, and then they put it back inside the cell. And then there are things like plasmids, which are extracellular parts, and then they, not extracellular, extra nuclear, and it outside the DNA, inside the cell it works. We have just started working in this area because nobody in India really does that, and it's taken us very long to settle. We are using a single negative feedback, but what we are trying to see is what is the role of delay in transcription in gene expression. So this is a typical picture where a bacteria has this kind of a fusion with GFP, and this is how it looks. This is just a picture to show.
But what is the picture of?
This is the picture of E. coli, which is showing this green fluorescence protein, which means
one is
the green color. So these are, each of them is a cell. Okay, so when it's fluorescing means that it's expressing. High fluorescence means higher expression. So this is how it looks under the microscope, but we are just looking at two different circuits, one without the delay, what we call it is a delay circuit, and with delay. And this is the kind of variability you get in experimental results. Initially when I used to look at them, I said, oh, this hasn't worked. But basically what this shows is the control circuit has higher fluorescence and variability is less, and this has lower fluorescence, and it's based, so it's a lot of statistical analysis of these two to see whether the delay in gene expression affects gene expression itself or not. And we are just working with it. We have a model for this, simple negative feedback, but then here are situations where the simple ODEs don't work because the number of molecules are so low, so we have to use stochastic differential equations, and we have just about started working. Oh, well, you have to work in what is known as low copy plasmids, so there are about just six, maybe 10 to 20 copies. So it can be a problem. I mean, if I'm telling correctly, I don't know. Okay, so most of our work is on forward engineering, in the sense we are trying to model existing pathways and learn from there. Now, there are a few things that one needs to keep in mind. One is that they have to work in a reliable manner in the face of unpredictability, both in internal and external environment. So the question one asks is, are there any sets of regulatory designs that confer such kind of functional effectiveness or robustness? But they also have to be such that they can evolve to new structures and functions. So they have to have the ability to behave in a robust manner and also have the ability to change. The dynamics of the dynamical state of the or the output of the pathway is obviously always experiencing noise. So one would like to know how much of noise level leads to change in the observable dynamics. Now, when one looks at in terms of attractors or in terms of steady states or whatever it is, in a highly robust system, one would look for a situation where under noise the attractor is unchanged but maybe fuzzy. But in a less robust system, the attractor changes shape or approaches a different attractor. This is an interesting statement which I like. Like, especially people who are working on artificial designs, it's true that all designs that are not physically forbidden can be realized. We can make it. But they are not. But not all realizable designs are functionally effective. And what you see in biological systems are only the ones which are functionally effective. That's all. Okay, so what we have done is what I'm going to show you is first is a model existing pathways, and based on a specific reaction, we have first developed a simple model, then we have studied the dynamics of the model under different arrangements or different structural designs of regulation, and then we have studied the dynamics of the pathway under realistic changes or mutations, and also some stochastic variation reaction. Okay, now here is where the simplification starts. So here is what I showed you earlier. Now I'm going to simplify it as much as I can before I try to write an ODE of it. I'm only interested in amino acid metabolism. There are 20 amino acids, of which I'm taking only this group, which are called the aromatic amino acids, which these are the three ones. And this is a reaction pathway of starts from a single, goes through several steps, and then it branches into two. And then each branch, or one of these branches again, make another branching, and this is. And these are all the regulations that I have shown here. So each one, each of them can regulate the first step. So it can channel, it can regulate the channeling of the flux of the pathway there. And also each one of them can regulate at the branch point here. This has a lot of variation in different microorganisms. I've just shown some dots. What, like in another bacteria called B. subtilis, these reactions, these extra regulations are there, and this part is not there. So the regulations are quite different, and it's interesting to see why it is. Now, what I'm going to model is actually this part, only this part. And that's what I'm going to show you. Now, when I want to, so what I showed you, that small part is this. It starts from a particular substrate called coracemic acid, goes to 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth step is, goes to 5 steps, and makes this amino acid called tryptophan. It's important because humans don't make it, and we have to eat, take it as food additive. Bacteria and lots of other organisms make that. So it has its own biotechnology interest, if one can really make this. Now, as I told you earlier, each of these steps are activated by enzymes, and these enzymes are made from a piece of DNA through the process of transcription and translation. And what I have shown you now is what I call as a biochemical pathway for biosynthesis of tryptophan in E. coli. Is this is the genetic part, and this is the metabolic part, and they of course overlap. So this reaction will not go on unless all these enzymes are present. All these enzymes can be present only if the transcription and translation happens. This set of, there are 5 genes. These 5 genes give rise to these 5 molecules of proteins and enzymes. And then they differentially work at different steps. There are 2 regulatory controls here. One is this end product. So this is an end product inhibition here on the first step. And the end product also binds to another molecule and goes and inhibits the genetic reactions. Okay? So this is how this pathway looks in a simplified manner. So here is the genetic reaction. There are 2 levels of control. And this is the metabolic or enzyme inhibition. Now, even this, I don't think I can, I would like to simplify it, because there are 5 steps here, and there are 5 enzymes, so, and there are 5 genes. I can't go on writing. I would not like to write a model which will have 15 variables. This system particularly was very good, because when I looked into the biology of this pathway, it was interesting to see that all these 5 genes that are here are actually transcribed together, because as I told in jargon, there are 5 contiguous structural genes which code for the enzyme. So once transcription starts, it has to pass, read through the entire thing. And all the enzymes are made together. Okay? So I can consider this entire messenger RNA as a single variable. Then, as far as regulation is concerned, it happens on the first step, lucky for me, because it happens, since it happens on the first step, the rest of the enzymes basically are slaves of what is happening to the first step, as far as there are enough enzymes to work with. So I just lump all these enzymes into a single variable, and since they act in a concerted manner and the regulation is on the first enzyme, I take that as a single variable. And of course the most important one, which is responsible for regulation, the tryptophan, I take as the third variable.
What about the other errors? That seems to be regulation at all.
Oh no, these are just to show that this gene makes this gene and this gene makes proteins which act, which are these enzymes. So, and this enzyme acts on this step, and this enzyme acts on this step. So there's a little complication here in the sense of, in some organisms, these 2 genes make this enzyme. Some organisms, there's another gene here. But the everything depends on how it's being regulated here. Once transcription starts, it goes through all the processes, all the enzymes are made. So that's why, if there is less inhibition, there's less, more enzymes made. If there's more inhibition, less enzymes made. There is no differential activity inside there. So, pardon me?
Basically, you're appealing to the, what you call slaving.
Yes, right, right. So since I'm interested in regulatory, the role of regulation on the behavior of the pathway, I've been able to simplify this particular complex pathway into just a three-variable system. So here we are. I just went through that, to show that how one can use biological information to make simplified models, but the information really has to be on your side to do that. So this is what my tryptophan biosynthetic pathway is. So it has one negative feedback, it has another negative feedback here, which is through receptor-mediated, repressor, another molecule, protein molecule, repressor-mediated repression. Okay. Now, this is not universal in all organisms for making tryptophan. So there is this whole area called comparative pathway analysis, where people are looking at the gene organization to see how, and also regulation, how these are different. So different structural designs can show distinct functional dynamics and also the degree of robustness to environmental noise. And the kind of structural designs that one can get here are not too complicated. One can either get this complete regulation of two negative feedbacks. One can get one of them not there. There are some genes here, some organisms which show absence of this negative feedback, and some show absence of this feedback. Okay. So these are three different arrangements of regulatory processes. Now, I would like to go through the modeling results of this and this. And this is completely stable. There's nothing that one can do. It's a very stable system. And see if there are differences. Now, how does one model such a situation? And this is, I would like to show this because this is to say that I could have simply given the model, but I think it's interesting to see this. Okay, so I want to model the first step, that is the gene repression. There are several different biological facts that I've listed here that I have to take care of when I want to write a model. Okay, then if I want to model the enzyme inhibition here, there are several different facts that I have to look into the biology to model. And of course, then there's degradation kinetics, and since it's an amino acid, it's used up in protein synthesis, etc. So without writing the detailed model, this is how the a typical ODE would look like. If I want to see how much of messenger RNA is being made in time, how much of protein is being made in time, how much of amino acid is being made in time, these are the functions I have to find out. This is the repression function. So the source is being regulated by the repression, and then this is the second inhibition function. Okay.
Those APs and Cs, they stand for kind of not only one. Since you kind of clump the model, they stand for several components.
Yes.
So how do you get them? These
so I. Oh, so what I do is, so this is basically the first enzyme, anthracnase synthase. I don't consider the rest of them are just doing. If anthracnase synthase is not active, rest of them, even if they are there, nothing happens because the flux is not channeled from one step to the second step to work on it. Okay, so there are some papers that I've referred here, which are basically crystal structures and genetics and other papers, from where I looked into those papers and found out some forms the way the genetic repression work. Process works. While I was doing the work, the results changed. Initially, it was known that the tryptophan repressor binding to active repressor is a cooperative process. So then the form of the reaction would be like this. Then in this paper, they said that it is not a cooperative process, and then the whole this is the functional form. So we have worked with both later. And hence, the functional form for gene repression would be this. There is a certain amount of mathematical derivations to go from here to this form. Okay, and I'm not showing that. So it's a two-step process. It goes from repressor to active repressor, tryptophan to repressor binding, and tryptophan repressor binding makes it active repressor. That active repressor goes and sits on the DNA, binds on the operator, and then shuts off transcription. So it's a two-step process, and that's where there are two binding constants involved here. One of them is hidden into this term called gamma or R, which is, there are lots of differences in these parameters because sometimes the Mac didn't read the older parameter, and I don't know, anyway. So these are the parameters which, this parameter is related to the strength of inhibition. And this is gene dosage. This is the transcription rate of transcription. And this is rate of translation. Okay. Now, if I want to model the metabolic inhibition, the enzyme inhibition process, then one looked at the tryptophan and ancillate synthase crystal structure is known, so one can get some idea about how the binding follows a particular type of kinetics, which is again kind of cooperative Michaelis-Menten kinetics, and that's how this one looks. It's similar to that, except that we know two molecules are required for binding, and hence the rate of utilization of the end product in protein synthesis is given by this form, and we could either consider it as a linear term or as a hyperbolic form.
Time is not the derivative of that, it's just some other function.
Which one?
F prime.
No, F prime is just
some other function.
H. Okay. So this is how the dimensionless form looks. Looks cleaner. This is what the dimensional form looks. You can see I'm still going from transparencies to PowerPoint. So we can make this set of equation dimensionless, and this is how it looks. Now X is for messenger RNA, Y is for enzymes, and Z is for tryptophan. And basically what I'll show you now are partly in analytical and partly numerical results based on steady state analysis, bifurcation analysis, and numerical simulation of how this pathway behaves when I change these parameters or I make changes in the
A's, B's, others, concentrations, log of concentrations, or just number of molecules?
No, these concentrations are in terms of volumes per, say, millimolar per cell and things like that. So they are not numbers. So when I go back and put these values back make it into dimensional form, there'll be some volume per cell type of concept.
It's reasonable to talk about concentrations, and in many cases have what, 10 to 15 quarters of a molecule per cell.
Well, it's reasonable if these are in larger numbers, then that's why we can use a ODE formalism. It's not reasonable when we are doing transcription, the kind of work that I showed you, where we have to actually look at these as stochastic variables, or even use a different formalism. But to some extent, at least these numbers are quite high, and it works.
It's not the stochasticity, which kind of, that will be a problem as well, but just the fact of taking a molecule and getting it from the place where it's been produced to a place where it's going to be used takes time. It depends on what the geometry inside the cell is. Does it have to pass through some of the pores of different things, etc.?
I don't know the answer of the question whether geometry of the cell is important for biochemical functions. It may be.
Use it all the time, and they argue that diffusion can't be big enough, so it's kind of mixing with that.
Maybe non-diffusion is maybe polyphic transport across some sort of maybe.
Yes. Some functions are definite.
There's not much holistic going on.
No, I mean, something can carry it across the. On
molecules,
for example, on the
atom. Yeah, but there are shoulders that have problems.
See,
one to another one, it's pretty much confusing.
But when you're talking in terms of ion channel reactions and diffusion of calcium through ion channel, there are things, the geometry is important, what kind of, because the geometry decides the number of ion channels on this. But these are much more kind of in-field approximation. So this is a single negative feedback pathway where there is only one negative feedback, and what I'm trying to show you is one of those designs where there is a single feedback, not, and then I'll go to the second two negative. So, okay, how do we get parameter values? Now that's important, because if I earlier people used to put all these as one and work. and they never got any oscillations, anything. But if we really have to understand that much of biology to be able to look into all these parameters that people have found either through experiments or indirectly that they have reported it somewhere. Nobody really reports numbers that here is a paper where all these numbers are given. These are collected from so many different papers. And then we can look into use those functions that we have used for making the equation dimensionless and then put it back, and this is what the parameters set is for this particular reaction. This is when the pathway is so-called normal or wild type, the cells are just normal. So this is how it looks. These are degradation rates of the A, B, and C. This is the utilization rate of the end product into protein synthesis. This is an indication of the strength of repression of transcription. Now, this is the repression function, and this is just to show if I increase the cooperativity, that is the N, then it becomes more and more the slope is stronger. And for the same value of N, that is cooperativity, it also depends on, it becomes more and more steep as I increase the inhibition or gene repression, the strength of repression. So increased cooperativity and increased repression makes the inhibition much more stronger. That's all this says. If one considers the normal pathway, this is the set of values that we have taken. This pathway is always stable, and that's what is seen in normal cells, that the tryptophan synthesis increases and reaches a steady state, depending on the requirement of the cell. But that's not very interesting from the point of view of dynamical systems. So we would like to see what are the conditions under which this pathway can be destabilized. And so one of the things that we can do experimentally is change the strength of repression, because one can make mutations at the bindings at the proteins and or genes and which can give defective proteins, where the strength of repression is changed. And these are three-phase plots to show that if you increase the strength of repression, you can actually get oscillations. Okay? This is stable, or wherever you start to come back to the steady state. This is, it oscillates around this within this stable limit cycle at this value. But what is interesting is you get bistability in somewhere higher value of repression. And this bistability is like, it's a coexistence of a steady state and an oscillatory state. So what this tells me is that depending on the initial concentration of the molecules in the cell, the cells can show two different phenotypes, either oscillatory or stable, which is interesting. This is just the bifurcation diagram to show that for different values of G, so that bistability is essentially a subcritical hop bifurcation. We have done that. And it just shows that what is the dependence on the value of G. And this, as G goes up, that is more and more tryptophan is used up in protein synthesis, the subcritical hop bifurcation is slowly kind of getting reduced, and the range of the subcritical bistability range decreases. We have also changed several parameters to see how the two-parameter plots to see how under what parameter values the system can show stable oscillations and regions of stability. It is clear that there is a region in both the degradation rates of the messenger RNA and the utilization rate of the end product that we get regions of stability and regions of unstable behavior. Okay, now because it has a bistable state, it is going to have very different dynamics on if there is random perturbation in the cell. This is to show that when the parameters are such that it's in stable region, there's no effect. Both in stable region and oscillatory region, two fairly large perturbation, random perturbations bring the system back to its original dynamic. But when it's in the bistable region, even small perturbation can take the system from one type. So I start with the stable pathway, I give a small perturbation, it comes back to the steady state. But if I give a slightly larger perturbation, you can see that it goes to the oscillatory state. So it this tells that this pathway, a simple pathway with a single negative feedback, actually can show two different phenotypes.
And as you mentioned, also the transient behavior may be important. Right.
For what? Tell me again.
You mentioned that the transient behavior may be important.
Yes.
And so it's even more sensitive to transient behavior.
Yes, right. So, yeah, you're right. So if there are, essentially what I'm trying to say is that here is a situation where it is sensitive to noise, and here it is not sensitive to noise or perturbation. Not so much, yeah.
What we're seeing here is what you showed a little while ago, where you have an equilibrium point in separatrix and Lumen cycles. That's what this is?
That's what it is.
Okay.
It's just the effect of subcritical Hall bifurcation and bistability is this. This is what one would see, one would affect. Now, if I take a two negative feedback system, that behavior is lost. And so the additional parameters is I have this inhibition here, inhibition term. That's the, and I also have, instead of, one can work with just G or with this functional form. In this case, what we can show that as this is for different values of Y, how the inhibition function responds to different concentrations of the protein, or for different concentrations of the inhibition activity or the strength of inhibition. So for normal value, we take B as 0.33, so that's here. It's pretty steep inhibition here. But if we decrease the value of enzyme inhibition, then the inhibition is not as steep as it is when it's in the normal value. So in this case also, for all normal parameters, this pathway is stable, like the earlier one. But it doesn't show any bistability region. It simply shows either stable or oscillation. But we have to change several parameters to get oscillation. So it's not easy to destabilize the system. One has to make many mutations to change, at least two parameters to change. So, and there are these two parameter plots where it shows that increasing G actually reduces decreases the oscillatory region of the state. This is also similar to what the earlier pathway. And it's quite robust to noise. That is what it is, random perturbation, unlike the others. So what I've shown you is that it's just a comparison between a single negative and a two negative, two different designs. It shows that it is more difficult to destabilize the system with two negative feedback than one with a single negative. This extra feedback leads to extra stability against mutations. So this is just details of comparing. All right, just to say that one is not really talking completely theoretical. Somebody actually did this experiment. I picked it out from the journal. It's published in Journal of Theoretical Biology. And there they showed that normal feedback inhibition on the first enzyme keeps the pathway stable. And if you reduce the feedback inhibition, you can get oscillation. Okay? So this is the kind of results that one works for, thinking that, okay, the model at least shows what one has seen in experiments.
Did then you make some surprising prediction?
Oh, the prediction with respect to perturbation is definitely, because there's no nobody has really looked for bistability. So that is definitely a prediction.
And you believe that that's realizable?
That's realizable.
So that's something that could be checked.
Somebody should.
It's only a small part of it. More complicated pathways, is it kind of isolated?
Oh, so that's where these kinds of circuits actually help. If one can make it in a smaller way, yeah. Finally, my results are based on small models, so I should be able to actually forget about that pathway and make
the experiment you showed before.
Is for the real cell.
So, a lot of other things.
Yeah, but then see, at least it shows that if you just make a mutation at the protein which is controlling the first enzyme, that itself makes that difference. So there are one is to one correspondence to a fair extent, but one really doesn't know till one does the experiment whether your model is correct or not.
So, to follow up with this question, you can think of these little
circuits
as being reasonably isolated from what's going on in the rest of the cell.
Yes, there are always concerns whether the DNA that you are putting into these small plasmids interact with the main DNA of the cell or not. People use different types of use different ways. Some of them actually integrate these things into the main DNA so that there's no effect. The work that we are doing, we are using these small DNA sequences which are not present in the actual DNA, so it's completely foreign. So it stays in the small. Yeah, when you're working, so that's why it took us 3 years, 2.5 years just to get the basic circuit. We still don't have all the controls. You never know, I mean, when you're looking into experiments, how difficult they are. Okay, now I'm in a situation where I can talk to you about a model biochemical pathway, which is a combination of a positive and negative feedback process. And this is not what I'm modeling, but this is just to show that there are several different situations where in the same pathway you can have a combination of coupling of positive and negative pathways. So this is very simple, because the way we go is that, okay, now I don't have this negative pathway, negative feedback, but I have a positive feedback, and let me see how changing the structure of my regulation this way, how is it going to affect the dynamics of this particular system. So this is the term which shows the positive feedback, and the positive feedback term is complex because we are assuming several different biological functions of this enzyme. Some of them are things like it's a cooperative, it's an allosteric enzyme, and allosteric enzyme with a certain why we do that is because it's quite common to get this kind values for this kind of enzyme, parameter values for this kind of enzyme, because people have worked on cyclic AMP pathways and slime balls, phosphorylation pathways, where people have this kind of enzymes which act in positive. We have gone through the same procedure and got these values for the parameters, and almost always the normal system exhibits equilibrium dynamics. This is why the general idea is that homeostasis is the most common thing in biology. That is because. Okay, so I just gave you an example in the earlier one, how we look into each of these. So I would have to look into the interaction between the protein and this enzyme and this. So if the crystal structure data is available, I know how many molecules are going and binding into that. And it's
come out to be such even nice numbers.
Yeah, that's precisely why I showed that earlier, is transparency, that it requires a fair amount of effort. Otherwise, it kind of. All right, so this is my equation. These are all the different kind of assumptions. The positive feedback term actually obeys, is the enzyme. Allosteric enzyme, it is a dimer, all these things are necessary for people who want to know what the enzyme is like. Okay, and so I need N molecules, two molecules here for this two molecules of S3 to bind to E, that's why it's two here. And I've kept this as still N just to see the role of cooperativity. Okay, here is a negative feedback and here is the positive feedback. You can see that negative feedback again becomes more and more steep as I increase the cooperativity of the interaction. And the positive feedback becomes more sloppy, or the slope becomes lesser for decreasing values of the second variable, that's the parameter. This is to show how it's dependent. So here is a two-parameter plot, K and Q. K and Q are the degradation rates. We always work with degradation rates because these are rates which can be altered in a cell by doing some mutational analysis. One can obtain strains which have changed K and Q. And this is the role on the stability in the KQ space of the different N. And one can see this is the unstable domain. The unstable domain increases as I increase n. It actually was the other way around in the earlier.
What? I don't understand.
Okay.
So what's inadmissible?
Oh, this gives negative values of A, B, and C, which we don't take because these are concentrations. So the steady states and whatever it is, they are all negative. So we just don't consider negative steady state. So the white is stable. The parameter value is where it's, the pathway is stable, and these dotted area is where it shows.
If it's unstable.
The steady state is unstable. So it's a bifurcation analysis. So this is the point, if I keep changing this, at this point the steady state, the positive steady state is stable, and the eigenvalues, and the, this is unstable. So I still, I'm going to show you what happens inside.
It's actually crosses that are better.
Crosses is the steady states. Crosses the oh God. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Right, it doesn't matter. Inadmissible.
Inadmissible is the situation which is supposed to be this. I'm sorry that this has got changed. Right. So these are inadmissible, which means the steady states are negative. I'm sorry about this. And this is the area where the steady state is unstable. And these are the white areas where the steady states are stable. Okay. This figure is analytical.
What do you call this inadmissible? The parameters are still... And they still exist. It means that the description of the term is equation.
Yeah, but it's just...
It's just meaningless. But the parameters... But the model doesn't work, right? But
how do you know the model works?
Yeah.
So you will get to zero, and you'll stay there, you will just not go to zero.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is when it goes there, I can just make it zero. But what... If you just take them as three equations and do a KQ parameter state, first look at the what kind of, you'll get three steady states anyway, it's a three variable system. So one can, there you get negative steady states. Okay, if one wants to look at what's happening inside when the steady state is unstable for a particular value of n, you get, for different values of n, you get this picture. This is numerical. And as one increases n cooperativity, one gets different types of dynamics. So this is the region one gets more complex and chaotic dynamics, and these are the regions one gets limit cycle oscillations, and the dark dots are stable. Okay, hope it's clear. So we are here, where at a particular set of parameters, we have a region where this pathway is stable, we have a region where the pathway is oscillatory, shows limit cycle oscillation, we have a region where it's shows more complex oscillation, but it crosses and it's kind of a like a isola, I don't know what to call it. It depends on different values of n. I won't do this because we're already late. Now this is how the time series looks when I change values of k and q. And what it's just showing what happens when I say that it's limit cycle, then it's complex, and then it's back to limit cycle, and then it's again stable. If I just cut across that. Now, what was most interesting, and this is completely numerical, and it took us very long to get this, is that we saw that there are ranges where there's coexistence of two types of oscillations. One is this green, so this is overlapped, plotted as overlapped, and one is blue, which is a very fast oscillation, and this is a slower and high amplitude oscillation. They are they intersperse with each other, very difficult to separate. And then it comes out, as I change the parameter, comes out to this high period, high amplitude oscillation, and finally it's stable again.
It's quasi-periodic?
It is, between here and around this region, it shows all kinds of things. We have done some analysis. So this is just to show how it looks in some parameter values, not necessary. But this small oscillation actually goes to a period doubling bifurcation, and then it shows this kind of a picture. And of course, a lot more complexity around this region. It goes, comes out, goes again. But we did try to do some sort of a analysis of that, this oscillator. Now you see, this is a three-dimensional phase plot where I plotted the larger oscillation, which we call as type 2, and the smaller oscillation, smaller attractor, type 1. Now it's very clear that the type 1 attractor is really not really three-dimensional. It's so flat. And that's why we could plot this Poincaré map. And we tried to look into, it came out like a one-dimensional, in a one-dimensional map form, but it had these kinds of extra arm to it. I don't know what to make out of this. But it definitely shows that this is some sort of a chaotic attractor.
Now, for the molecules, you may not be able to dissolve anything like that, right? It's an infinite number.
I don't know, yeah. Really don't know.
Fluctuations are quite substantial, right?
Yeah. what I'm going to show is why it's important when you have these kinds of things. So this is how typically the attractor looks, and these are the analysis. Interestingly, because it's so flat, it's a three-dimensional system, but this attractor dimension is about 1 point something. So we haven't gone beyond that. Now, this is the birythmic. So there's a range where the system is birythmic. You have coexistence of these two types of attractors. And one of them is really takes a large excursion in the phase space. Other one is much more. So we wanted to see what is the basin of attraction of this, of these two attractors, because we were not being able to separate to show that, okay, it's bistable, it will go from here to there if I put this much of perturbation. And when we did this initial condition analysis, and this is all we could do, at, at different scales, we got this kind of a result. So what this shows is you start the simulation with a particular, say, the small attractor with different initial conditions, and the blue one shows where it goes to the small attractor. It stays in the small attractor, and the cross shows that you start with a small attractor, but it goes into the larger one. And it is similar across scale. So these are non-chaotic attractors. These are two non-chaotic attractors, but their basin of attraction is what we would call it as fractal, because it's across scale, it's like that. Now, why is it important? Why is it interesting? What would be the effect of noise in the dynamics of such a system when you have this kind of? So, of course, random perturbation, completely unpredictable. You don't know where you are going. So that's one point. So it just shows three different. We also did a phase sensitivity to know if there are some parts of the phase of the attractors are sensitive or not. It shows that if you look at the large attractor, only most part of it is quite insensitive. If you start here, it give a perturbation, comes back here. But this part seems, the steady state is somewhere here. Okay, this part of the phase is. Okay, so I'll just skip the parametric noise. Okay, I mean, if I'm, skipped everything. Anyway, all that we showed there is that not only that the basin of attraction is fractal, but all which shows up in the cellular behavior as if you have any amount of noise in that parametric region, there is complete unpredictability. And this is the pathway either shows small oscillation, suddenly comes up with a large excursion, and then again shows small or very. Whereas that is not what happens. So this is just when you take parameters which are in these oscillatory regions, which are very different. And there, the noise in parameters or even in steady states actually just, this diffuses the attractors but keeps them same. There it doesn't, it changes the shape of the attractor itself. So let me conclude. If you look at the design of biochemical pathways, of designs or structures or arrangements of feedback, then the single negative feedback system is more flexible in a range of dynamic that it exhibits than the two negative feedback system. Two arrangement of negative feedbacks clearly shows the advantages conferred by addition of feedback in terms of increased stability to mutations and environmental noise. Source is, of course, the second feedback, because we can separate it out and see, because it affects immediately. Now, addition of positive feedback to the single negative feedback pathway destabilizes the pathway, and a wide variety of dynamical behavior is seen for changes in parameters. And environmental and systemic stochasticity can expose or conceal the dynamical properties of this pathway. So this is a corollary from here. If it's on the very stable, robust regions of parameters, then it's still, you can still see what is the type of attractor. But if it's not in the, it's in that bistable region, then one cannot, one just is unable to understand whether it started from a small attractor or a large attractor. There are several examples, or several biological examples, where people have looked into cells and their behaviors, and they have made statements which are something which actually comes very close to what our results show. One of them is this, that it is impossible to produce clonal or identical cells. There is always an irreducible level of random variability. And this is also seen, because as one goes through the cell cycle, you start with a single cell and divide into two, it divides into two, the genome is the same, but still, because of the number of molecules inside the cell, may not get divided into the same numbers, and these can be regulatory molecules. You can have an isogenic population, same genes, but it can have different phenotypes. That has been seen. So that's what, and hence their behavior would be different. That has been seen, and we think, you know, one of the mechanistic, dynamical reason could be something like what we saw in the earlier model. So it can exhibit both noise-sensitive and robust behavior under changes in substrates or parameters. Under even small noise, it shows these. Transfer from one small amplitude oscillator to the large amplitude attractor, and hence it's possible that this could be one of the underlying dynamical methods of producing these kinds of things, which are called sparks and puffs. Now, this is a mechanism which has not been forwarded earlier. But this is perfectly possible, because lots of calcium oscillations have both positive and negative feedback. So this transient signaling, which happens under no external perturbation, this comes up as sparks. It's possible for a model that we have shown. And then different types of amplitude and frequency coding of oscillations have been seen, again, in calcium for diverse cellular processes. So having these specific combinations can actually give rise to different, trigger different types of processes. I'll stop here. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not going to talk about the collective. Thank you very much. Sorry for being so long. There are a lot of questions.
One other question, but somewhat longish comment, continuing what I already mentioned. So you mentioned a paper here by Jelovic and company on the Visolator paper. There was a second paper from the same group, Stambon paper, where they were just using different possible pieces of
combinatorial.
All possible combinatorial
yeah.
ways of connecting different pieces of genetic circuits. And the conclusion of the paper was basically they couldn't model that with binary circuits. Fine. So a friend of mine and I, we decided to play with this and to actually get parameters for to model those networks as chemical kinetic equations. 48 parameters, we couldn't model what's going on. We added another 40 or so parameters to describe random noise. Maybe it's noise that you know, produces the strange results. So we have about hundreds of parameters, the best possible fits can, you know, get the result we should do. And so the conclusion which we have, which may be correct, maybe not, is that when you're talking about this real cell and the performance of the stuff in the real cell, you must talk about how things get from one piece to another piece and who carries them and how it goes and what is the possible mixing work, whatever. Otherwise, if you have 100 parameters, in principle, you should be able to fit everything with 100 parameters, but we can't.
Yeah. Well, this has been This has been a concern always, and people who do experiments, they always have this concern. There was a time people said you cannot pick up oscillations in cells because it's constantly getting mixed. There's so many background signals, how will you pick up? But people are really developing methods to do either inside the test tube or at least make the cell in such a manner, put the circuits in such a manner so that it can be, the background is kind of less as. But this concern will always be. But the idea is to show that models have been there for so long. I mean, people have been doing these models from 70s, 60s. But it's only now that they are being put into test. It's only now. See, first paper is 2000. And unless we really do it, we don't know whether what we are telling is all nonsense or whether it's possible to do or not. I met Elowitz last week, and the positive feedback, they are doing a positive feedback now, and we'll see.
Maybe I quickly respond to that. What's the time scale? The gene regulation stuff is a long time. We talk about minutes. And for any reasonable diffusion coefficient, you shouldn't have any spatial effects there. Those are really slow things.
But, sorry, if you're talking about, say, E. coli, the genome E. coli, it goes all across the cell. And all the organelles in the cell, there's no nucleus in the cell. Right? So the genetic mechanism occupies the whole cell, and then you have organelles all over in different pieces. So if you want to take something which is produced in the left corner of the cell, and it needs to react to something in the right corner of the cell, it won't be feeling anymore. Actually going across, in many cases, you're going across linear.
They're all there.
You actually have to get through a mesh, for example, and you cannot get through this mesh until somebody pushes you from behind and really pushes you through this mesh. So there are many different things.
The enzymes that you're transporting. Yeah. You think there
oh, these oscillations are on tens of minutes, so you can measure.
No. He's saying that these molecules are so big they can't fit through the actin network or something.
In many cases they cannot. So for example, the small one, the left eye which you're talking about, it's a small one. I believe it's a small one, so it can go reasonably smoothly. But the other one which they're using is. I don't know which one of them is like it. I think it's just Tatar, but and in many cases it's just that doesn't go through.
And those are these experiments like Collins or Hasty. These are the theory and the experiments are perfectly well without any
in there.
But doing is very difficult. Doing is very difficult.
The experiments which they've done with this Cromwell paper were basically just. It's exactly the same topology of the network, and you only replace which of the guys is actually acting as a repressor for the other one. Topology is exactly the same, all of the same, weight, quantum, etc. Just replace the numbers. Basically, what it means is that you replaced the geometry. One of the repressors is small, the other one is large. So you just replace who is large, who is small. And this changes the output of the network.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's so much distance between the real system and your models that it's only going to be convincing, or at least you can demonstrate usefulness, if not correctness, if you can make non-trivial predictions. If you can say, if you do this, this will happen. And
somebody does the experiment to prove that.
Right.
That's the most difficult one.
These are not representations of what's going on. These are ways to manipulate things in a controlled and predictable fashion.
Yeah, but
it seems to me that unless you can do better than mere intuition, namely, you have all these arrows, you have all these pictures, which is the way people do things, and so if you do that, then you expect this. unless you can have some mathematics that does better than that, it's clear that you're not representing what's going on. So the question is, what are you representing?
And oh, I think
you're representing the ability to make predictions.
Yeah. So there are two things. One is whether one, I partly agree and I partly don't agree with you. One is that it's only now that people are able to show that predictions from models are possible to be shown. Okay, so these models, if you look at these repressor and other models, there are mathematical models which show, which use the same circuit. They model it and show the same results. So obviously it has to be, either you can say it's completely unrelated, that model has nothing to do with that, but the model is based on those three repressor circuit. So I really don't completely agree that what, if you build a simple model, then that doesn't represent the system itself. It does, and people have shown it experimentally that it does, that it's they see.
What I'm saying, you're always vulnerable to the criticism that you've left something out.
That's that. All theorists are that. I mean, no wonder.
So the only answer, but here the distance is very, very large.
No.
So your answer, it seems to be, is to say I can make non-trivial predictions.
Yeah.
I don't see what other way, what other criteria, because these systems are so complicated and these simple.
No, you can.
So simple.
Do you give string theory people hassle?
No, you can make non-trivial predictions. The predictions you I made, I think they are non-trivial. Okay,
right.
But the point is who will say whether it's non-trivial or not? Somebody will have to do the experiment.
Right.
Okay,
right.
We'll wait.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Can I ask it?
That's the difference between having the paper in Physical Review and having the paper in Nature.
Can I ask just sort of a general question about the, connected with this, you know, spatial effect? I mean, maybe you can have a fairly well-mixed picture and everything like that, and maybe with very small gradients in an initial mix, but it's possible that because you have, say, you know, a different dynamics could occur in this region and this region, that would suddenly build large gradients. For instance, if you had these bistable factors, and if the parameter happened to wander into one range here and another range here, you build up very steep gradients. So even though initially the diffusion-like effects are small, they become very dominant. What criteria do you use to say, well, you don't have to worry about that?
The only way one can test this is to look into the system behavior under a certain amount of stochastic noise, and then see what is it that you're getting, and see whether if you build a circuit like this using typical DNA sections, and see how is it reporting, what kind of dynamics is it reporting, does it match with the. So if I predict if the model predicts that I'm supposed to see under noise a certain amount of small amplitude oscillations, very noisy, and then a very large excursion, then it's completely random. But I do see as if there is like we have seen in these calcium meetings earlier, that you get these spark-like things. If I can make a small circuit, put it in the cell, and get behavior like that, I think it's pretty good.
In the 90s, I mean, you get the calcium puffs and all these things because you have these discrete sites where things are different than anywhere else, so that you need some.
Yeah, I mean, those things will stay, but then at least the way things have gone on is people are now able to take out only the regulatory parts of the pathways, put it into a smaller pathway, put it back into the cell, and see whether what, because the models are always simpler. One can write a 200 differential equation model, but what's the point? There'll be 500 parameters. Here, if you can make it simpler, if you can predict things which is possible to be checked, it's worth it. I think.
Peter, you want to make an announcement about
today, sir?
We have just a reminder this afternoon, we have a talk at 2 p.m., I believe.
And Monday morning.
And Monday morning you had another talk, was it?
By Alan Newell.
At 10:30.
So this afternoon it's about turbulence, and Monday morning it's about phase equation.
Thanks very much. Thank you.